First, so far was we had the effective Lagrangians, variance number, and Lepsius number are preserved for the normalizable part by accident. Huge success. L5 breaks Lepton number by 2 units, would look like neutrino masses, could be a huge success. We looked at an underlying model that produces that, which was a stereo neutrino story, which was an example of a portal. And you guys were going to find the other two portals. I want to now look at a model that gives you the baryon number violation, because people wanted to see guts. And so I know that Sean started off by telling you some of this, and then the plan will be that this will take not all of today, and then I want to do the rest of today, this morning, and then this afternoon with a kind of a telegraphic summary of supersymmetry. That's my goal. So the gut story, as I understand, you've seen it. So this is the simplest example of a grand unified theory. Grand unified theories are ones for which the three independent gauge couplings in the standard model gauge group, SU three color cross SU two left cross U one hypercharge, they each are allowed to have a separate gauge coupling because the gauge couplings are forced to be, all the generators of SU three have the same gauge coupling because the failure to commute forces the requirement that the Lagrangian be invariant under the non-abelian symmetry forces all the generators to couple with the same strength. But because these ones commute with each other, there's no symmetry reason why they have to have the same normalization. One way to think about this, the size of the coupling, is that the coupling always appears together with the generator. So you can always completely absorb the coupling into the generator. And when you do that, because the generator satisfies TA with TB, I times C, C, A, B, C, then if you absorb the coupling into the generators, then you have to also absorb them into the structure constants. But once you've done that, then they're gone. And that's kind of one of the big successes of gauge series. That's really the statement that these things also appear together with the gauge fields. And so by scaling the couplings out of the interactions, you put them back into the gauge kinetic term. But that shows you that they're universal, that everybody couples the same way, and the symmetry is forcing you to do that. But it only forces you to do that in a universal way for all the generators that don't commute with each other. There's a similar story for gravity. You know, we write Newton's constant in front of the Einstein term rather than inside all the interactions for the same reason, that you can scale Newton's constant out of the interactions and put it into the kinetic term. And the gauge theories are kind of the poster child of that. So the thought behind grand unification was, you can embed the gauge group. You know, this gauge group gets broken at low energies down to SU3 color cross U1 electromagnetism because this factor breaks due to the Higgs. U1. So the thought is, can we embed that group into a bigger group which is semi-simple so nobody commutes? There's no commuting factors, so the couplings will all be forced to be the same. And the observation is, actually, you can. The idea will be that spontaneously broken at some higher energy, and then this will be the low energy theory that we're looking at with this standard model gauge group. And you guys saw with Sean that a generation of standard model fermions perfectly fits into a pair of representations of SU5, where you're imagining the gauge group, this gauge group is embedded into a 5x5, instead of being 3x3 or 2x2 unitary matrices, we have 5x5 unitary matrices where the generators look like this, where the top three pieces are the SU3, and the bottom two are the SU2. So this is our color group, and here's our standard model left-handed SU2 group. And hypercharge will be something which is commutes with these two, but is diagonal, and so that'll be this one. So this is the unit matrix in the 3x3 slot, so it commutes with that. Unit matrix in the 2x2 slot, so it commutes with that. Satisfies the trace is equal to 0 because all the generators of SU5 do that, because the S in SU5 is the determinant is 1, and so that means the trace of the generators is 0. So that basically told you what the... I've chosen the normalization of Y here to be one that will give us the right hypercharge for this five-dimensional representation. If I act on... The way that those generators act on this thing is just by multiplication, because the five-dimensional representation is the defining representation of SU5. So color just acts on these guys. They're a triplet. I've taken the index I, which goes from 1 to 5, written as something goes from 1 to 3, which is color. Something goes from 1 to 2, which is SU2 left. And the hypercharge you see has the right numbers to be the hypercharge of the right-handed down quark, because that's its electric charge. That's minus a third. And then this is the hypercharge of the lepton doublet, which is a half. So the normalizations work. It's conventional normally to choose, for the generators in the defining representation like this, for SUN, it's conventional to choose, I'm kind of defining this because I'm going to use this again later on. Normally, there's a lot of freedom in how you normalize the generators, because you can basically change the scale of the generators that's trading. Part of your definition of your gauge coupling in the end of the day will have to come with a definition of just some convention as to how you normalize your generators. And the convention for SUN is that you normalize the fundamental representation such that the trace of two of these things is always delta AB. That's just the Cartan metric, I guess, of this group. And the thing that's in front of delta AB is the thing that depends on the normalization. And that's often called T of R. So it's one of the indices of the that characterizes representation. And the convention is, once I've chosen this normalization for something like the fundamental representation, that will determine what it is for the adjoint representation and other representations. And the convention is that for the fundamental, call it F for fundamental, that's equal to half. And that's because if you think of what you do with the Pauli matrices in SU2, the generators were 1/2 times the Pauli matrices. And if I did this calculation for tau A, tau B, I would have had 1/2 delta A B. So the convention is we do the same thing for all SUN for the fundamental representation. And so in particular, it's true for SU2, and that's what you do for the Pauli matrices. But if you go back and look at the Gell-Mann matrices, they all have this normalization. These T's are going to play a role in how the couplings run. So I'm going to come back to that later on. So just remember that's how they're defined. So anyway, this Y does not satisfy that. I've chosen the Ys to give you the right hypercharges for the 5. But the thing that will be normalized correctly will be this. And that plays a role when I say that the couplings are the same for all generators, they're going to be the same for all the generators that are normalized in the standard way. So they'll be the same for T. There's always this conventional, if you want to talk about the standard model U1 coupling, there's this factor of square root of 5/3 that you have to keep track of, because you're normalizing the hypercharge differently than the standard generators of SU5. So the rest of the generation goes into an antisymmetric tensor representation. Now this is these are right-handed fermions in the 5, so the left-handed fermions would be in the 5 bar. And the rest of the left-handed fermions are in the 10, which is an antisymmetric combination of two antisymmetric tensor with 5 by 5 matrix. And the way it fits in is here, where you remember, if I take I, the index that runs from 1 to 5, and write it as being the 3 color indices and the 2 SU2 indices, this makes it explicit here. This is antisymmetric in alpha beta, which is the 3 by 3 part of it. This has one of each, 3 by 3 and a 2 index, and that's the other one. So those are the quark doublets. And the lepton, right-handed lepton conjugate is here, and it has an antisymmetric. So this is really the 2 by 2 matrix, 0, E, minus E, 0. So that was the picture of how the fermions fit into an SU5 representation that I think Sean told you about in your class before. So what I want to do is flesh out what the several things. I want to flesh out what the, when Sean talked about this, he emphasized that this is kind of a little bit of a complicated representation for the fermions, and you could do other groups like SO10 where you could put everybody plus a singlet right-handed neutrino into a 16 of SO16 and so on. And when you did that, the fermions got an easier representations, but he was emphasizing that the Higgses got more complicated, which is true. But what I want to focus on is, at face value, there's just craziness in this whole picture, because at face value, the couplings, we measure the couplings for these three things, they're not the same. And so the statement that they're all the same will only work because the couplings run. And so the hypothesis that's being made is that there will be a scale at which the three couplings in the standard model could at one point have the same value up to that square root of 5/3. And that has implications. And in particular, that story tells you that the gives you a prediction for the scale at which the symmetry breaking must happen, which breaks SU5 down to the standard model gauge group. And the nice thing is that it gives you an answer which is similar to the size that it has to be in order not to have been ruled out by proton decay. So and I want to also then look at the other kind of predictions. In particular, because there's more symmetry, there's more things that were unrelated in the standard model become related, and it's not just the gauge couplings. And so I want to just highlight a few of those, and then that'll be all I'll say. So so we've talked about the fermions, and everybody in the fermion sector can be light because it's just the standard model fermions. But we know that there are some particles in the problem that are not light, because we know that some of the gauge bosons won't be light. They won't be at the weak scale. They're going to be broke. When we break SU5 to SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, those X's, what I've written as capital X in that 5x5 matrix here, those are the things that were not in the standard model. They're going to get masses. And their quantum numbers we can figure out because we know how the gauge bosons transform under a symmetry. They always transform in the adjoint representation. And you remember that the adjoint representation, so let's talk about the spin 1 and the spin 0 particles. I won't say a whole bunch about spin 0 because Sean said a fair bit of that already. But I have to say something because I want to, the masses will depend a little bit on how we break the symmetry, so we have to make some choices there. So so to break the symmetry, the break SU5 down to SU3 plus SU2 cross U1, the standard choice is the one that Sean described. We can choose a new Higgs scalar field. And the simple choice is to choose that field to all be in the same, transform in the same way under SU5 as does the gauge fields. And the gauge fields are always in the adjoint representation. So we'll choose, what do we call this one? I've used phi, I've used psi. Let's call this whatever this is called. So we'll choose it to be in the adjoint representation. So that's the same as the gauge fields. And so you know that for SUN, that's the number of Hermitian traceless matrices there are. And so that's going to be always n squared minus 1. If you have an n by n complex matrix, there were n squared things. Had to satisfy that it was Hermitian, so that imposes a bunch of conditions. Had to be traceless, and so you're left with n squared minus 1 independent generators. So that would have been 3 for SU2, would have been 8 for SU3, and it'll be 24 for SU5. That's the 24 representation. And the adjoint representation, you remember, I don't know how much group theory that you've got in this course. It's one of those things. Have you had group theory?
We had group theory at the beginning of the year, like yeah. Front course in group theory.
Was that discrete groups or Lie groups? Or?
Yeah, Lie groups.
Lie groups. So you know about representations and yeah. You know what the adjoint representation is?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So basically what we're asking is that that this field is going to transform by commuting with the generator. So it'll be, you know, I times, so if I take some symmetry parameter omega times the generator, then the transformation rule in the adjoint is this, and I commute the generators with the field, and because the fields are also 5x5 Hermitian traceless matrices. So you can kind of see that what we're looking for is we want this field to have a VEV, which is not zero, and we want it to break SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 down to, or sorry, SU5 down to the standard model, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. And the way to do that is to arrange our scalar potential, which I won't write down, to have a minimum such that, so we want we'll choose V such that the minimum is proportional to Y, basically. So we'll just choose it to be, you know, let's say tell us W. Now we need to have something, so I guess we want to have minus three halves W. So it's unit matrix, traceless, with some size W, which we'll get by minimizing potential, which is the VEV of the field, and zeros otherwise. That has the property that if I ask which generators are invariant, by construction, it's going to be true that all the SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 is going to be unbroken by this, because hypercharge will commute with itself, because this is basically proportional to the hypercharge. And then this is 1 in the SU3 sector, and it's 1 in the SU2 sector, so it's going to commute with the SU3 cross SU2. So the only ones that won't commute with this will be the X's up there, the capital X's. So that does what you want. And of course, we're going to need a Higgs to break SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 down to the U1 electromagnetism. So we'll also choose Higgs field, and we can choose that to be a 5 as well. So that'll be something which will be, there'll be a 3x3 piece, call that chi, and there'll be the Higgs. And so we'll have to design our potential such that this also gets minimized at a non-zero value. So we want H to be, you know, zero for this guy, because we don't want this guy to get a BEV, because that would break SU3 color, which would be terrible. We have to have Higgs non-zero. But what we do want is we want, let's call this 0D, the way we've done before. But what we're going to want is we want V to be 246 GV, because that's the standard model story. But we're going to want W to be much bigger than that. And so this is kind of how the hierarchy problem will come in a concrete way, that when we wrote our Lagrangian down in the standard model, all we had was the weak scale to talk about amongst the particles we knew, and then we imagined there's some big scale that we didn't know what it was, which was suppressing L5 and L6. When you look at a specific model of what the physics is at higher energies, it tells you what the scales are that are going to appear everywhere. And so I'm going to be focusing on the size of the scale that appears in L6, because I want to know how the X boson masses are going to be related to the proton decay lifetime. But one of the problems of the hierarchy problem in this grand unified language is that the splitting in mass, this field here is going to be very heavy. If we design a potential to give a minimum that satisfies this and this, where W is really enormous compared to V, like 10 to the 16 GV, it's hard to get, or this guy is going to want to have a BEV, have a mass, which is kind of the order of W. And so the splitting between this guy and this guy is only really arranged by tuning terms of the potential in a way which isn't stable against radiative corrections. And so one of the problems with these models is we're going to find that when we look at corrections to the Higgs mass, at the classical level, it's not generic that if you write a potential down that the Higgs will have a very small mass. It, generically, once you make this BEV big enough, everything wants to be that big, and so you have to start adjusting things very carefully to make the Higgs BEV small enough. And then radiative corrections don't tend to preserve choices that you make. So the hierarchy problem becomes much more focused in a specific model, because you have explicit degrees of freedom with high energy that you can integrate out and ask what they do. So I'm going to come, that'll be the topic of symmetry, so I'm going to ignore that for now. But you can make a potential which does what you want classically, if you're happy to just choose by hand all the coefficients in that potential. And once you do, then what will happen is that this X field, you know, the things up there, they're gauge bosons, and they're going to, we know how they transform under SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, so we know what their quantum numbers are. We know their electric charge, for example. So this is going to be a doublet under SU2, because you're going to see that X is like 3x2 matrix. So color acts on the 3-component part of it, and SU2 left acts on the 2-component part of it. So if I focus on the 2-component part of it, this is going to be a doublet. And it's traditionally called X and Y. So the capital X is the whole doublet, and X is the capital is the top guy. And The hypercharge of this thing, we know how to figure it out because it's just, we're supposed to take the transformation law for the gauge field, which is the same transformation law as the Higgs had because they're both in the adjoint, and ask what happens when I do it with hypercharge. So if I take delta x under hypercharge, that'll be, you know, I, y, x. If you go through the exercise of commuting y there with x there, then what you find is that the hypercharge for the x doublet is 5/6. It's the sum of the, you know, of 1/3 plus half is where that comes from. So when you, in this commutator, when you multiply one side, you get x gets multiplied by half. And we take the minus the things in the other order, you get the 1/3, so you add them together, that's where the 5/6 comes from. So that tells you that the electric charge of x will be, it's always hypercharge plus the third component of isospin, so this will be 5/6 plus a half, and that'll be, 3 plus 5 is 8/6, so that's 4/3. And the charge of the bottom guy will be 5/6 minus a half, so that'll be 5 minus 3 is 2/3. Done that right? Make sure I haven't lied to you yet. No, it should have been 1/3. So it's 5 minus 3 is 2, 6, which is 1/3. We can check that because we also know what the vertices are, and this is kind of heading towards the variant number violation story. That we know that the Lagrangian is going to have, inside the Lagrangian, there'll be things like psi bar b slash psi, which will be, you know, psi bar b slash minus I gauge coupling, all the gauge fields. Let's call it that. So if I think of that for these guys, and I do the same thing for these guys, you can kind of read off how everybody couples. And what will happen for the SU3 cross SU2 and E1, the standard model is they're going to do the standard thing because we designed it that way. But we can see in particular how the X's couple to the fermions. And you can kind of see what's going to happen is that this term is going to have a piece in it, which will be something like X mu times the generators that go with X. Let me call this whole combination capital X, including the generator. We're going to have here, for the, if I take the 5, the down in the L, D, L, here we have D and L bar. And this X, you know, is a matrix that's up here and up here. So what's going to happen is that this is going to pair off with L and D. So we're going to get things like D bar L, and we'll get L bar G X dagger D, something like that. So these new gauge bosons, the ones that are getting a mass when we break SU5, are coupling. A lepton can turn into a quark and emit them. So in the same way that when you emit a gluon, you change the color of the gluon, of the quark. And this, what's going to happen here is that we'll have transitions where we'll have an X. Let me just make sure I write this properly here. So the kind of the vertices you can have here for X, we're going to get things like E plus and anti down. That'll come out of this vertex. But if we went to the 10, there's a similar thing which says we could have had a U with a U because the U's are here, the Q and the U are. One's the left-handed, one's the right-handed piece. And so we can check that, that this makes sense. If I ask for what's the, I read off from here, what's the baryon number, the lepton number, and the charge, then the baryon number here would have been, because it's an antiquark, it's going to be minus 1/3. Lepton number is going to be minus 1. So from that I can get B minus L. B minus L is going to be minus 1/3 minus 1 is minus 4/3. Not do that right. Oh, because I can't add. 1 minus L is plus 1, minus 30 is 2/3. And the charge is going to be plus 1. D would have been a minus 1/3, but because it's an antiparticle, it would be plus 1/3. So that'll be 4/3. So that fits because we know that X was supposed to have charge 4/3, so the electric charge is working. And the reason I'm doing this is that the fact that the X connects a quark to a lepton doesn't in itself mean the baryon number is violated, because I can, in principle, what I could do here is I could assign X baryon number minus 1/3, and then this interaction preserves baryon number. And same thing for lepton number. The important thing is that I can't do that consistently for both this and this. So if I go over here and I ask, what's the corresponding statement? What's B? What's L? What's Q? Here, this is two quarks, so B is equal to 2/3. No leptons at all. So B minus L is again 2/3. And this is the sum of two up quarks, so that's going to be 4/3. So you see that the electric charge and B minus L can be consistently assigned to these vertices in such a way that these interactions do not break electric charge B minus L. For electric charge, that was obvious because we had designed the whole thing that way. But B minus L, it wasn't so obvious. But there's no choice for the baryon number of X, or the lepton number of X, which makes both this and this conserve B or L. So the interactions of X with the 10 and the 5 bar, the interactions of X with the 5 bar alone could have been made baryon number invariant by assigning baryon number to X, but you can't do it for both of them and get the baryon number to work. Similar story for Y. So the lower part of the doublet, the transitions that are in here for Y are, you get things like the antineutrino and neutrino conjugate D bar. You also get Y coupled to the down quark. So if we go through the same exercise here, the baryon number here would have been just, again, 1/3 because it's an antiquark. Lepton number is going to be, it's an antineutrino, so that would be minus 1. Electric charge is, it's the antiquark, so it's going to be 1/3. And that's what we expected for Y over there. And again, B minus L in this case is 1/3 plus 1, which is 4/3, I guess. I always get that wrong. So what did I put? B is equal to minus 1/3 because I'm an idiot. I was doing electric charge, but this is the baryon number of this thing. The quark is 1/3, so the antiquark is minus 1/3. B minus L is 1 minus 1/3 is 2/3 again. And then if I do the same thing here, baryon number here is an up quark and a down quark, so that's going to be 2/3. But the number is 0, so again, B minus L is 2/3. Electric charge is going to be the sum of an up and a down quark, so that's 2/3 minus 1/3 is 1/3. So that is consistent with that. That is consistent with that. But these are not consistent with each other. And these are consistent with each other, which says that this whole capital X multiplet, X and Y, have the same B minus L charge. So the upshot is the XY couplings mediate delta B unequals 0, or delta B equals delta L unequals 0, or X equals plus minus 1 transitions. Let me not commit myself to that because I'm not completely sure that's right. So we can iterate these interactions as well. So it's like selection rules for flavor for the W boson. But the important thing is that they're equal to each other, but they're not equal to 0. And that's consistent with what we saw for, you remember when we went to the dimension 6 terms, everything we wrote down had delta B equals delta L equals, delta B was equal to delta L. And so if you first came to this model, you might have thought, oh, great, this is a way of telling the SU5 model from the SO10 model because it's going to preserve B minus L, and I might be able to design something else that will not preserve B minus L. If you are able to design something which is not preserving B minus L, you will either have to have the proton decay happen through an interaction at low energies which has got dimension higher than 6, so it'll be more suppressed, or you'll have to have different light degrees of freedom than the standard model. by comparing that to what was generic in the effective Lagrangian, you kind of see what was robust about the prediction and what is something which is specific in telling you about the Lagrangian. So the point of this is, one of the points of these is that now if you calculate the graph, you can be more precise about the proton lifetime. So the proton lifetime . So let me just quote you the answer. I've written all these notes on the backs of them. So what you can do is you can explicitly integrate out the stage boson here, and you get G squared for the SU5 component divided by mx squared times operators corresponding to these four fermion things. And these will be in our list so these will be contained in what we called L64. But now it has a very explicit coefficient and not just some random scale. And because of that, we can turn this into a bound on mx. I should have said here that when we give this VEV, one of the predictions will be that mx will be my, and that'll be basically g times w, up to a factor which I may not be right. W was the BEV of the 24. And what I'm missing here is the exact statement that I wrote down for what the... mx squared. The numerical factor is 25/8. But having said that, I'm not seeing where I wrote down the mass. I apologize for that. But there's anyway, the proton lifetime implies mx is bigger than something of the order of 10 to the 16 GeV. But you can do better than something of the order, because this is a very specific prediction for how big it is. So there's a more precise value than what I mislaid here. And the important thing is that it involves mx and g, but g we're going to be able to get a handle on because that's related to the couplings which we measure. So g is fixed by the alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3 center model. So the uncertainty here will be in these m's. All right, so let me get to the predictions, the gauge couplings, and then also for the Yukawa couplings. That's so annoying. I know that this class is going to end, and I'm going to go back upstairs and say, oh, yeah, that's what the mass was. All right. Okay, so predictions for mx, or I guess for fermion masses. So the prediction for, let's start with the predictions for ms. This is not a constraint anymore. That's a constraint. It's saying that proton decay would be wrong if that weren't true. But here we get a prediction for mx, and that's coming from unification of the couplings. So you know that, I'm pretty sure you guys did this. I didn't check it though. That if I have a gauge interaction, And I ask how the couplings run, it's coming from, if I have scalar fields coupled to the gauge field, And you have graphs like this. These engage fields as scalars. I've got fermions. I've got graphs. Very good. So those are scalar loops that contribute to the propagation of gauge fields. Here's a fermion loop that contributes to the propagation of gauge fields, and of course the gauge fields contribute to the propagation of gauge fields. So if I kind of evaluate all those loops, those are changing. The way you can think with these things is that we're normalizing the F mu nu piece of the Lagrangian. Gauge invariance will kind of constrain everything except for the normalization. But the normalization of this thing, if I have scaled the couplings out of the generators, as I told you you could do up here, then the coupling appears here as being minus 1 over 4 g squared. So if you start telling me how you've changed the normalization here, you've told me that you're changing coupling, and that's kind of how you see that the couplings are running. So if you evaluate those graphs, and of course, if you're doing it with gauge theories, you also have to be about ghosts and things, depending on the gauge theory, you have to stick in there. But it's kind of a standard exercise that tells you, if I take alpha, define it to be g squared over 4 pi, usual way. And this is equal to 1 over alpha at some other scale, minus b, which I'll come back to in a second, log of these two scales. So they run logarithmically. And so if I were to, I might as well say it now, so where b, if I evaluate those graphs, it'll tell me what b is. B is 1 over 12 pi times. So for each complex scalar, I have to take all the complex scalars in my theory. They're in some representation of this gauge group that we're talking about for this coupling. And let's say that gauge representation, I call that R0. That's the representation of all the scalars, complex scalars. So this is coming from this graph and this graph. Then this T is the thing I defined up here. It's the Dinkin label for that representation. I take the trace of the generators in that representation, and I calculate the thing in front of delta B. That's what I mean by T. That's what appears here. And that's appearing here because in the Feynman rule here, you've got the generator, which you're going to eventually do the trace over, and then that naturally comes up. And the same thing will come up for the fermions and for the gauge bosons. So there's the corresponding contribution from this graph gives you twice the T for the spin a half. This is for the left-handed. Take all the fermions. There's right-handed fermions and left-handed fermions I could talk about, but what I'll do is for every right-handed fermion, I'll talk about its antiparticle, so we'll just talk about left-handed fermions. Take all the left-handed fermions, and there's a huge column vector there, which is some representation of this group called R a half. Then I take the same Dinkin label for that, and the numerical factors from the value in the graph give me the 2, and then I'm left with that. And the same thing for the gauge will give me, from these two graphs, will give me the Dinkin label of the adjoint representation with this famous sign difference, because the fermions and the scalars are screening the gauge interactions, whereas the gauge bosons are amplifying it, because the gauge fields are sourcing the gauge field. And so this is the part that's like gravity, that the gravitational field is a source of gravity because it carries energy, and so that makes the coupling want to get stronger at long distances rather than being screened. And this is the famous answer. If I plug in the standard model what these things are for the Higgs, for the quarks, and for the gluons, then you get the famous, this becomes the 2 times the number of quarks minus 33 or something like that for the standard model. For the running of color, for the running of the color coupling. And I need to tell you what T of A is. So this is the Dinkin label for, because most of these things are in the fundamental representation in these examples we're doing. For the adjoint representation with this, that's going to imply that the adjoint representation satisfies that this is equal to N for group SUN, which is the one that's really interesting. So this kind of tells you how the couplings run. So reality check would be, so if I take this thing, let's take the contribution of the gauge fields to the running of the SU5 coupling. So for SU5, the 24 H bosons, they give, well, it's just going to be, there's nothing here, nothing here, just gauge bosons. So we're going to get minus, B is minus 11 over 12 pi times 5. Because T of A in this case is N, and for SU5, N is 5. That's minus 55 over 12 pi. And we can check that everything is making sense, because I can also do this calculation separately for the SU3 and the SU2, which are inside SU5. Let's repeat for, this is B5, B3 and B2 using field content of the 24. So for SU3, everybody's in the adjoint representation, right? Because what I'm doing is I'm taking the X's and the gauge bosons in SU3 and the gauge bosons in SU2 and asking, and also B1, asking how do they, if I just use this formula again, apply this formula to those, I should get this, there's a consistency check here, which is going to make a point I want to make. So what we're going to get is we're going to get 1 over 12 pi, get the minus 11 because we're always talking about gauge bosons in this case. So we'll get the 3 for the gluons, because if we take this thing and I apply it for the SU3 adjoint representation, I'm going to get the gauge bosons. It'll give me a 3. But then what I have to do is I have to add to it the contribution of the X's. And the X's are behaving like, they're behaving like gauge bosons that are, that are in the adjoint, but I've got a number of them. So they're not in the adjoint. The X's are transforming, transforming as triplets under SU3, right? So what I have to add then, the sign will be the same because it's still gauge bosons, but I'll have to add, so the important thing is that the counting here, so as far as the counting goes, it's much like the scalars, but here I'm counting complex scalars. So, but the gauge bosons were real scalars. So there's going to be a factor of 2 coming from the fact that I'm counting real things. So that's 2 because they're real. And then we'll have, so it's a triplet, but we've got 2 of them because there were 2 SU2 labels. So there's a 2 for the SU2 label. This is the real, this is the fact that they're complex. I'm saying this. These guys are real, but those guys are complex. There's X and there's the X dagger. This is coming from the fact that there was a doublet, an SU2 doublet. And then we have the Dinkin label for the fundamental, which is a half. That's minus 11 times 12 pi. If I've done this right, so we get 3. So we get 2 times 2 divided by half is 2. So 3 plus 2 is 5. And so it's giving the same thing that we got when we just full SU5. And we can do the same thing again for the SU2. So that'll now be 2 for the SU2 gauge bosons. And now we have complex X's again. So there's a 2 here. But now we have 3 of them because it's a triplet of SU3. But it's in the fundamental of SU2, so it's a half. So here we have 2 plus 2 times 3 divided by 2 is 3, so that's again 5. So any way you slice this formula, if you're consistent about it, if you do it for an entire SU5 representation, you get the same answer, and it's the answer you got for that SU5 representation. So if you want these couplings for SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 to differ from one another, as they run in scale, you can't sum over an entire SU5 representation, because that's going to make them all run the same way. Because as long as they have the same, the running doesn't know that you broke SU5 in that case. So the message is only slit 5 representations cause alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3 of the standard model to run different. So in particular, all the fermions, everybody in the fermion representations, they're all light. So if we run from high energies down to low energies, as far as the SU5 is concerned, they contribute the same way to every coupling in SU5. So if we plot 1 over alpha against the scale, mu, then what we're expecting is, actually, let's plot it against, do a log plot against log mu. What should happen is that the contribution of everybody who's a full SU5 multiplet will have all the couplings will run parallel to one another. The running will be straight lines because 1 over alpha is a constant plus something that's linear log of mu. And so what will happen is that let's say this is the scale, mx is a scale where we think things are unified. After that, things are non-abelian. So in the non-abelian case, b is negative. So 1 over alpha is growing. So alpha is getting smaller at higher energy. So there'll be some running, which will be the SU5 running. Below mx, what will happen is that there'll be some particles will become massive, and so we'll integrate them out. Whereas the other particles will be light, and we'll leave them in. So in here, only split representations, which will mean in our gauge bosons, the x's stop contributing below mx, but the light. So what happened is that we'll lose these factors above below mx and this one. So now they start to run differently, the SU2 and the SU3. But it's also true that the Higgs will do that. So if, wherever I wrote the Higgs, probably I wrote it on the top board there. I'm losing it in the layer here. There should be a, yeah, the very top there. The Higgs, the chi and the Higgs are in a 5. The chi, if it's up at the, if it has a mass up at the x, at the mx scale, it'll stop contributing to the running, but the Higgs will continue. So just those guys are going to cause the couplings to run differently, but they will run differently. And they're, for the SU3 and SU2, what'll happen is that they're going to climb with different slopes. The SU2 will climb more slowly than the SU3 will. So what'll happen is that there'll be some, say this is SU3. The SU2, and a similar story for U1 will be it'll fall because it's abelian, so it doesn't have the minus adjoint thing. Let's U1. So the thing is that if you assume that they all unify at some point, so that they're at some scale they were the same, you can figure out now, since we measure what they are down here, what I'll do is measure that guy. We measure that guy. We can figure out where mx is, assuming that the only split SU5 representations are the ones that we've identified. So if only the Higgs, what do I call the Higgs up there? It's HX, the gauge. Say the Higgs 5, possibly the 24, and the gauge 24 contribute no mx, then what we do is we just take the difference. The assumption we make is that this value is the same when we do this for SU2 and for SU3. So when we take the difference, this will cancel. And then we'll have the difference of the couplings at low energies where we measure them will be given by the difference of these coefficients b times the log of the same ratio. So we'll get a formula which looks something like 1 over alpha 3 minus 1 over alpha 2 at some scale mu will be given by minus b3 minus b2 times the log of mu squared mu naught squared. If we assume that alpha mu naught 3 is equal to alpha mu naught 2. And then what we do now is that we know this because we calculate that with this assumption. We know these because we measure them at low energies. And so we read off we know what this is because that's the energy where we do the measurement. Then we read off what this is. That'll be mx. And so if you put in the numbers properly, that turns out to say that mx will be mu times the exponential. It's an exponential because we're undoing the log here of 30 pi divided by 201, 3 over 5 alpha em at mu. What people have done is they've traded the G2 and G3. They traded G2 for electromagnetic coupling because it's better known. And so that, if you put in the numbers, is 2 times 10 to the 15 GeV. So because it's exponential, because things are running logarithmically and the differences are kind of order 1-ish, and there's a 2 pi running around that helps you out, you're naturally led to scales which are kind of up there, which they would need to be if you wanted to get the proton decay right. So that's kind of a nice thing. But you also have a check, because you got that number from these two lines had to meet, basically, if they weren't parallel. Third one doesn't have to meet the same place. So since we measure all three of these things, you can extrapolate them up. And what actually happens with the standard model, if the story I told you now, if you really did this, it does something like that. There's the errors are now small enough. Back in the day when people first embedded these theories, the errors were big enough that you could have believed that they were going to intersect. But now the errors measured at the z-pole, so if you measure things at mu equals mz, are sufficiently small that you know that if this picture that I told you was literally true, they don't quite get close, but they don't quite get close. But the interesting thing is that, present experiments don't quite match. But we had to assume that these guys were the only guys that were contributing. So there's a little bit of model dependence in that. And the interesting observation is that if we took the supersymmetric version of this, which we'll get to in a second, if you said that the supersymmetry was helping you understand why these the ultraviolet sensitivity of the Higgs mass is better understood, then this whole story would go through. But now, instead of just having the quarks and the leptons contributing, you have all their superparticles contributing too. So it's a different but very specific prediction for what would happen. And it happens that in that case, they do agree with the errors. So they would if the standard model spectrum is replaced by supersymmetric standard model at weak scale, TV scales. So people, how convincing you find that is a little bit up to you. I don't find it so convincing. Two lines had to meet. You tweak the other line enough, you can make it neat. But it is suggestive that the particle quantum you need is one that has other motivations. So that's part of it. This is all part of the circumstantial evidence that there's something going on up these very high energies that we don't quite parse. So since we're almost out of time, let me just finish. There's one last thing to say about grand unified theories. This is kind of a more or less. It's kind of a dry. It's a success in the sense that there's a very nice picture that shows the paper I'm working from here. George A. Quinn and Weinberg papers that they call this stuff out. It's nice that the scales that you're led to are large. It's less nice that you need to add more things, but it's kind of nice that the things you add to make the unification work are plausible things to add, as you'll see in a second when we talk about supersymmetry. But there's other predictions. So there's also predictions because there's more symmetry for masses. So you can use these models as ways to understand the pattern of masses. And so remember, masses are coming from Yukawa couplings. And so in the standard model, you had three kinds of Yukawa couplings. We had Q, D, phi, we had L, E, phi, and we had Q, U, phi star, basically. Those are the three kinds of couplings we had. And then we had enough parameters in the coefficients to account for all the masses of the problem. That was the statement. So this, in grand unified theories, depending on how many Higgses you have, you have fewer couplings to choose. So the way to think about that is if you know how the fermions transform under gauge transformations, you can figure out the Higgs you would need to be able to build a Yukawa coupling. And our fermions, you remember, the left-handed fermions are in a 5 bar or 10. And so the possible Yukawa couplings you could make would involve a 5 bar with a 5 bar. That would be if I had two of the size. It would be like a psi left times some Higgs. Or I could have had a 5 bar cross a 10, which would be if I had a psi left phi and some sort of Higgs. Or I could have had a 10 with a 10. And so if you ask kind of how do these things decompose under SU5, it turns out the 5 bar plus the 10 is a 5 plus 45 bar. This is a 5 bar plus 45. Plus 50. And this is a 10 bar. Plus a 50. So this is a I. So now it depends on what Higgs you have in your problem. But if we only have the ones that I talked about, we only have a 24 and a 5, then the only ones we can really use are these ones. Because we can build this Yukawa coupling with the 5, and we can build this Yukawa coupling with also the 5. And it kind of has the right smell to it, because in the 5 is the standard model Higgs, so it's going to contain the normal masses we normally would have had. But there's nobody else. I can't use a 24 to make a useful Yukawa coupling. So the other Higgs is just not playing any role in the masses at all. So that shows you there's only going to be two kinds of Yukawa couplings I get to stick in as parameters. And I'm explaining basically three independent ones at low energy. So there's going to be a prediction for the masses, how they're related to one another. And with this choice, what happens is that you get the prediction is that the MD, so if only 5 Higgs contributes, then the prediction is that MD is equal to ME, MS is equal to MU. So just by generation, it's just the last quark, down quark, is equal to the charged lepton. And that sounds like that's a really, really bad prediction, but that's in the same category of predictions as the prediction that the gauge couplings are all the same. So what we have to do is we have to take that prediction and run it down to low energies where we measure it. And that running will change this prediction a little bit. And so what it turns into is you get a statement along the lines of mb under mu divided by m tau mu is equal to MD at the scale from x divided by m tau times the ratio of the important running is the QCD running, alpha 3 x raised to the 4 over 11 minus 2 thirds in cubed. So that's the thing that's coming from basic running. And then there's a factor of alpha 1 u alpha 1 x. So that does a. So if you take the value of m tau as a given, you can predict what mb would be, and you get something which is actually not too bad. You get something like 5. So m tau equals given gives mb something like 5.5 GeV. So that's not bad. You do less well for the other generation. So this one is not clearly wrong, but these ones are suspicious. And the clearest way to see that they're suspicious is that you take ratios of those things and you get things that are not normalizing. And one of the predictions is, so you predict that MD over MS should be equal to ME over MU. And that's something like 1 over 207. Or is that something like 1 over 24? There's some uncertainty there, but it's not factors of 10 uncertainty. So what you find in these models is that if you take the simplest vanilla Higgs representations, you get predictions which are not all bad, but they're not all good either. And you can, of course, you can get fancier. You can say, well, supposing we had a 45 rather than a 5 playing the role, then we would have more parameters. And you kind of fix, you can start model building, but you start you start stepping away from the beautiful predictive part of the model and into the nitty gritty details. And, there's lots of it kind of went into a mire, and I think at some point it didn't go much farther because it's hard to know how you test these things. Even if you get them, these kind of predictions right, you know, what are you learning? So it's a pretty picture. It underlines that Baryon number can be violated quite plausibly at high energies, and we would never know at low energies because the energies involved would be quite high. There's a very beautiful picture as to why it would be violated, and it's because you're unifying the gauge couplings. But then the devil's in the details, and some of the details are nice, some not so nice. That's all I was going to say, but that's what you want to see more. So I had hoped to actually start supersymmetry a little bit already. So we'll just have a whirlwind supersymmetry.